Brunch.ca. From drag brunches to holiday cabarets, there's something for everyone. Check out the latest events and join in the fun. Visit dragshow.ca for all the details.
We are gonna serve
and work and turn
and honey.
I'm Jesse Brown, and today I'm talking about Trump's war on the press. And the guy I'm talking to happens to be the creator of my favorite podcast ever.
A few weeks before the election, I thought I might actually get an interview with Donald Trump. I had one main thing I wanted to ask him. In a second term, how is he going to treat journalists?
Wait for that. You probably know Brian Reed from his excellent series, S-Town.
My second night in Alabama, I finally get to talk to Jake Goodson. Jake's the guy who'd originally told John that Cape and Burt had bragged to him outside the Little Caesars about beating a guy to death.
Or from his other excellent podcast series, The Trojan Horse Affair.
It was supposed to be a basic bread-and-butter assignment. Go record a meeting. But afterwards, Hamza calls me and says when he showed up at the spot, the community center, at 5 p.m., the receptionist told him,
"It's been canceled. The event's been canceled."
Or from his earlier work on This American Life. But Brian Reed has a new show, and it's also great, and it is all about journalism. It's called Question Everything.
It's a small-town whodunit. Who is behind a brazen attack on a local newspaper?
Brian Reed and I got together last week to interview each other. I interviewed him about what happens to the free press when your government tries to crush it. And he interviewed me about what happens to the free press when your government tries to save it. Spoiler alert. Both can be bad. Wait for it. Hi, Brian.
Hey, Jesse. So how do you want to do this? Do you want to, like go back and forth question by question? Or, like, you take the first stretch, I'll take the next stretch? Maybe that makes more sense. Do you have a formal way you want to volley this? Or, like, structure these volleys?
I had been thinking that I was going to go first, then you were going to go. And then when you brought up the second, I'm like, oh, that would probably sound more dynamic. So
no, but actually, I take it back, because it's gonna be harder to get into a story, I think, actually, to do it that way. Maybe okay. We do it at the end. We'd try something like that. But I think if you're ready to go, you should go.
Sounds good. All right. Well, my first volley is about a very alarming story that you recently covered. Story of Rumeysa Öztürk.
30-year-old Rumeysa Öztürk was on her way to break her Ramadan fast with friends on Tuesday when six plain-clothed officers approached her. They take her phone and put her in handcuffs. Only then do they appear to identify themselves as police.
And I want to start with this one because it just sticks out like an ugly sore thumb. It's one of the most upsetting stories that I've heard about what Trump is doing to the press in the United States right now.
Yeah, this is a graduate student at Tufts University outside of Boston. Her name's Rumeysa Öztürk, and she's not regularly a student journalist, but she wrote, co-authored an op-ed in the student newspaper on campus, the Tufts Daily, last year, calling on Tufts to divest from companies tied to Israel, among other things. This predated the Trump administration. This year, in March, she was apprehended on the street while talking to her mom on the phone by ICE agents who were in plain clothes and wearing masks, and whisked away to a plane and put in detention in Louisiana with no charges. And the government never offered any reason for her detention other than this op-ed. It struck me as like a very scary, singular escalation against, you know, our specifically protected right of freedom of the press. You know, it was in the context of other international students also being detained for protest. But yeah, someone being imprisoned without charge for something they wrote in a student newspaper that just happened. She was finally let out a couple weeks ago. A federal judge ordered her released. But the chilling effect that has had, that we've done some reporting on, I think has been really, really significant, specifically on student newspapers around the country, where they've been inundated with requests from students, largely international students, to take down previous quotes or articles that they were part of writing for fear that it could impact their immigration status. Not to mention all the like proactive silencing that I'm sure is happening where people aren't writing things that they otherwise would have.
This is what I have trouble getting my head around, because if we look at these stories, you can very easily come to the conclusion, well, it's the same conclusion that I read in the Washington Post, Trump is fast dismantling the free press. We all have to stop him. That this is classic authoritarianism. This is a crackdown on criticism so that he can do what he wants without accountability or criticism. It's following a very well-understood strategy that, you know, authoritarian leaders have been working on for 100 years or more. And yet, as a Canadian who consumes a lot of American media, I flip on the TV or I check my feeds and I'm getting Jon Stewart and John Oliver eviscerating Trump as they usually do, mimicry and mockery of Trump. I can hear your show where you're reporting on these things happening. I can read that editorial in the Washington Post where it seems like a culture of very high level and thorough and unflinching criticism of Trump. People don't seem scared. And then there's just the general cacophony of the media conversation in America right now across TikTok and hundreds of and thousands of videos that come out every day where people are saying all manner of things. No one seems particularly chilled. No one seems to be choosing their words very carefully. It seems just as reckless in some places and just as laser focused and critical in more professionalized places as it always has, and which often looks more critical than Canadian media. So it's hard for me to reconcile some notion of like, oh, the brown shirts are smashing the printing presses and you got to get a license from the Ministry of Propaganda. That doesn't feel like what American media discourse is like, you know. And then I went, well, yeah, but give it a year. Maybe that's the track it's on. It still feels like a sci-fi premise, a dystopian premise, as opposed to the reality. The reality feels kind of unchanged to, I guess, a Canadian media consumer.
Listen, we're still getting our heads around it. It's happening around us in real time, you know, and that's part of why I have this show, is to be able to, or I've realized it's, you know, we launched a show before we knew what this administration would be or who would be in power, but I'm starting to realize it's part of the purpose of the show is to try and make sense of this as it's happening. I do think that it's more helpful to think of it from the ground up than the top down in terms of the impacts here. And what I mean by that is you're right. Like, I don't think, you know, I don't feel personally scared about what I'm saying, gratefully. I don't think Jon Stewart does. I don't, as I said, I don't think day-to-day experience of reporters at the New York Times has changed or that they are changing the way they're doing things, you know, this administration's steps and stances. What I just talked about with the, you know, self-censoring happening at college newspapers, that is a really big deal. I feel like it's underreported. I was surprised to learn it. I mean, you know, when we held an event at Tufts with our show while Rameza Ozturk, the PhD student, was still in detention, and we started advertising it for students and others to come outside of Boston. And proactively, this organization, the Student Press Law Center, saw that we were doing this event. They reached out to us. They're a nonprofit that gives support to student journalists, you know, high school, college. They've been around for a long time, and they, including legal advice and support, they have a hotline for inquiries that's been around for a long time. And they basically said, since Rameza Ozturk's detention, they've been inundated, record levels, with requests and questions from student journalists and student outlets around the country asking what to do with the requests they were getting from students to take down existing coverage off the internet, to erase columns that have been published. That is unprecedented to me. That is a really big deal. And it's really scary because it's hard to measure. It's not Rameza Ozturk in jail. It's like this diffuse thing that's happening on campuses across the country where we actually don't know. Like places, if they do, they are taking down some. They, you know, they're on a case-by-case basis. These papers are deciding to, in some cases, take columns down. And we don't know if they've been taken down. Like, it's a hard thing to measure. And then also they're explaining like, yeah, people who used to write for us, students are no longer writing for us. I think when you look at that, when you look at what's happening locally and just kind of like the attitudes about journalism and the press that you find out in the country, I think that's more where I see a lot of concern. And it's related to what's happening at the top, and it allows a lot of what happens at the top to happen. First Amendment attorneys who are saying, like, up until 5 months ago, if a student came to me and said, like, should I publish this column I want to write? I would say, yeah, do it. And now they're literally changing the legal advice they're giving to people because they can't, in good faith, if they're looking out for the best interests of, say, an international student, say that publishing this won't have an effect on you, that you'll be protected.
That's really interesting. And that's what I would give as advice. If I had a friend or a kid who was a foreign student at Harvard, if I was Prime Minister Mark Carney, whose daughter is at Harvard, she's a foreign student at Harvard, I'd say, you know what? Don't write for the student newspaper. Like, what do you need it for? You're coming back and forth from home. You're crossing the border. They're going to chat. You know, like, just don't do it. And you could look at that as kind of a first they came for kind of a thing, that if people who don't have the protection of American citizenship are the first ones who legitimately have to worry about what shows up on a Google search, it would be just sound legal advice to just not make political comments of any kind for a certain class of American resident who doesn't have citizenship. And you could kind of infer from that, like, well, that's where it starts and it's going to spread out. Is that the end game? Is this like a slippery slope thing? Because it's hard for me to reconcile. And this is sort of the eternal question with Trump is this just a bunch of chaotic nonsense that he changes his mind about every day? Or is this part of a master plan? When I think about who Trump is as a cultural figure and what MAGA world is like, it feels like it doesn't feel like a top-down controlled type of a media system. It feels like this is a creature of a chaotic media system. He says wild and outrageous things. It's not a very disciplined type of media communication. And how you could crack down on the criticism and just preserve MAGA media the way that he likes it while eliminating the parts that he finds unfair or a threat to him. So it's a long question, but do you have any sense of a master plan, like, of where this is going?
Chaos can be strategy as well. I think there's a certain sense of chaos, and I think it's not that there isn't chaos, and I agree that it can look that way as well. And I think there actually is a certain amount of chaos, and kind of, if you zoom out a bit, you know, we at one point had somebody compile like a list of every statement Donald Trump has made about the press since he started running for public office, like in 2015. What Sam came back with was massive. First off, he found this spreadsheet that the U.S. Press Freedom Tracker had put together of just tweets alone from Donald Trump about the media, which totaled well over 2,000. It was overwhelming to behold, just row after row after row of vitriol towards the press. And that was just the tweets. If you look at that list that we compiled, and then the actions that have kind of, you know, lawsuits and other actions, kicking people out of, you know, a press room, whatever else, that kind of track alongside those statements, that kind of does look like a pretty consistent strategy that's been building towards this moment. It doesn't look like chaos when you look at it with that view. Like, there's a lot of consistency there of, I'm going to use the media as a foil to fight with when useful. I'm going to go after them in real ways and ways that are theater, you know, and I'm going to systematically undermine public trust in the media, which I think is the most damaging thing that's happened writ large and demonstrable. So that really does look consistent and systematic to me from Trump himself. And then what's happened alongside that, you know, that we've been reporting on as well. So for instance, you know, we recently had on the show a New York Times reporter who's wonderful, David Enrich, who just published a book called Murder the Truth, in which he spent the last couple of years really uncovering, you know, it's not like a formal coordinated campaign, but a relatively coordinated and aligned campaign to weaken press protections here in the States, to go after specifically a Supreme Court precedent that is one of the most important for journalists here, New York Times versus Sullivan from the 60s, and to try and get it overturned in the way that Roe v. Wade was overturned here by the Supreme Court.
So what was this case? You hear about this case talked about, I believe this is from the 60s, New York Times versus Sullivan. Why is it relevant now in the context of Trump's actions against the press?
So New York Times versus Sullivan is a Supreme Court decision from the 60s that really set the tone and gave us the protections for the modern era of journalism in the U.S. It's what gives the First Amendment teeth in practice in terms of protecting the press. And it very specifically has to do with defamation lawsuits. And what it did was it set the bar quite high specifically for public officials and now public figures, so people who are CEOs, celebrities, as well as politicians, if they are going to sue a news organization for publishing something about them, there's a high bar for them to be able to win. Like, they basically, under that case, the news organization would have to be acting with what's called actual malice. Like, they have to really know something's totally true. I know you're not a murderer, and I'm saying it anyway. Then you could win a defamation suit. And the Supreme Court did that because they found that this happened during the civil rights era in the South. They found that politicians in the South were bringing really kind of not strong defamation suits against news outlets who were covering the civil rights movement. And it was silencing coverage, you know, and the Supreme Court was like, you know, for the First Amendment to mean anything here, even like a simple mistake where actually a news outlet did get something wrong about somebody, that needs to be protected to protect the larger goal of the First Amendment, which is really rough, vigorous public debate and scrutiny of public figures and policy.
Yeah, we have a similar thing here called the responsible communication defense to libel, where it basically gives journalists room to be wrong if you are wrong in good faith. All right, so New York Times versus Sullivan, that became a precedent that put teeth into the First Amendment. It protected news outlets for, I guess, decades. And you're saying the Trump administration is trying to overturn it?
There's a very specific, you know, campaign. It's got similarities with the campaign to overturn Roe v. Wade, which was successful, you know, which is aligned with Trump's stated wish to loosen libel laws here, which is one of the first things he started talking about when he ran for president the first time 10 years ago. And then separately to just build infrastructures to go after journalists, and in particular, independent and local journalists around the country. Like, David Enrich just uncovered kind of an ecosystem that's popped up since Trump started running of law firms that specialize in media suits, and they've built strategies and tactics that, you know, allow them to silence coverage, to, you know, not even have to sue, to just use threats to affect coverage, and then to file suits that are often pretty bogus. Like, they're not really legally sound, but just the fact of filing them often can drive journalists out of the work. And he, like, documents this over and over in his book. So I think when you look at things like that, it isn't very chaotic. It actually is, we should treat it as something that's a real systematic thing that maybe has this figurehead in Donald Trump at the top, but there's now an ecosystem that's built around it and movements and campaigns that are built around it to target, you know, specific legal pressure points.
As an industry that wants to survive and do its job, the only rational thing to conclude is, if you look at this holistically, you should act like this is an existential threat. And there's no need, I guess, to read the tea leaves, because Trump's been very overt about this. He has said they shouldn't be allowed to say the things that they say. There will be consequences if I'm elected, and now he's elected. I guess I believe him. This matters to us because all of this shows up in Canada, not just because we consume so much of your media, but the culture of attacking the press, using the press as a foil or as a punching bag, that was, you know, mimicked by our conservative candidate for years and up into the last election. And the press culture and the political culture, we just catch the waves from you. And so there's immediate and down the line impacts for Canadians as to what's happening in the States.
The other thing I'll say that I try to keep in mind as well, that I think is important to keep in mind, like, I learned it from David Enrich's book, actually, that I was just talking about. It also didn't just come out of nowhere with Trump. And he was drawing on something that was really there. That is also something I think we as journalists have to reckon with, certainly in the States, and maybe it translates to Canada too. And the thing I'm thinking of specifically is in 2016 or 2015 into 2016, there was a very kind of high profile legal media case here against Gawker, the online blog that Hulk Hogan, the wrestler, brought after they published parts of a sex tape of his, and he sued them under a privacy claim.
Hogan's $100 million lawsuit over a tape that was posted online by the website Gawker.
Gawker becomes convinced that somebody else with a different agenda is financing this lawsuit.
Billionaire Peter Thiel, a co-founder of PayPal, is secretly paying the expenses of Hulk Hogan's legal fight.
He won a huge settlement that put Gawker out of business, and then it came out that actually the person who financed that lawsuit was Peter Thiel, the Silicon Valley tech billionaire.
Okay, so Peter Thiel, just in case people aren't familiar with the guy, he's essentially a James Bond villain.
We could never win an election on getting certain things because we were in such a small minority. But maybe you could actually unilaterally change the world without having...
He's a Silicon Valley investor. He was like a co-founder of PayPal. He was the first outside investor in Facebook.
Technology is this incredible alternative to politics. The task in this world where politics has become so broken and so dysfunctional is to find a way to escape from it.
He is a filthy rich Silicon Valley guy who became a big donor to right-wing politicians and right-wing political causes.
J.D. Vance will be the next Republican senator, a victory for Peter Thiel, who spent millions backing J.D. Vance.
He had had a longstanding vendetta against Gawker for coverage about his personal life, but also about tech. David, in his book, kind of tells the story of how Peter Thiel brought basically like an operative on to source a case to then go after Gawker, and Hulk Hogan's case ended up being the one. But in mounting that case, the trial was heard in Florida in 2016. They were doing jury selection for the case and interviewing, you know, people who lived in the Tampa area about their feelings about the press in part. And it was kind of distrust and displeasure at the press that came out in those interviews. Again, this is just as Donald Trump is starting to run for the first time, that convinced Peter Thiel to be an early supporter of Donald Trump. He saw something happening already in the populace, a distrust of media, of elites, that then he was like, oh, Donald Trump's actually speaking to this. I think this is a good bet. Pretty fascinating.
That's amazing.
It was like market. It was like kind of like market or polling research for him, this jury selection in this case.
It's so interesting for so many reasons, because distrust of media elites could have been the slogan for Gawker.
Right.
Right. But that didn't matter. There was something in the air, and people, you know, like people have always been pretty suspicious of reporters and pretty quick to, but something was growing that associated the media writ large with the establishment.
So that was preyed upon and taken advantage of, but it was real. It was there. And that's something I think we have to keep in mind. It's not just like Trump came in and did this to us.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I have a sense of what you're talking about. Like, you know, there's like that phrase, like the people are never wrong. And as dumb as it seems, all of this, like the media are the public enemy stuff, there does seem like, I don't want to say the media had this coming, but the public was not wrong that something has gone very wrong with corporate media in the States. Like their lack of trust is based on something. And even just the moves that the big networks, the big private networks have made just recently kind of back that up, that there's just something hollow at their core. That is not something you could say about NPR. And like you've had a professional relationship with NPR, like working for public radio for most of your career. It's not like in Canada where the CBC relies on the government for like most of its funding. NPR gets like 1% of its funding from the federal government. I think PBS, it's also not a big chunk. It's a lot of money. NPR, they get over $1 billion from the federal government. But, you know, it's not a big piece of their funding puzzle. And yet they are fighting back. I know you don't work like for NPR. I guess you work with them. Can you give me like an insider's perspective on what's going on there?
NPR just sued the government and Trump this week. I'm curious to see kind of what impact that has on the way NPR is perceived. The fact that it's standing up to the government that way. Like I've thought it was interesting. I don't know, if you look at, you know, the criticism of publicly funded media is that maybe it's in the pocket of the government in some way or another. You know, it's not truly independent. But yeah, but then I'm just thinking about it even just freshly this week. Like if you look at supposedly independent corporate media organizations like ABC, which ABC News, which settled with Donald Trump after a lawsuit, and CBS, whose parent company Paramount is in talks to settle with Trump, and is, you know, it's causing all sorts of problems at their news entities. It's at CBS News and 60 Minutes. Like, you know, those places are caving or settling with the administration, whereas NPR is suing. And I just think it's kind of interesting that, you know, public media gets branded as the one that's like in the pocket of the government, possibly when or more susceptible to government pressure. But they're the ones actually responding with a lawsuit in this case. And it's a reminder that corporate media, there are plenty of levers that the government can pull on them as well.
Okay, stick around. After the break, Brian's going to ask me some questions about Canada. All right, Brian, you want to trade places here? I have been asking you about what it's like under Trump to work as a journalist. I'm happy to answer any questions you've got about what's going on here in Canada. Fire away.
Okay, cool. Can you tell me kind of the story of the Online News Act and how that came about? Because that seems like an epic backfire to me, but...
This is a wild one.
And what was the problem? How did you guys summarize the problem?
The problem was the news media told Canada and told the Prime Minister that big tech was stealing our news, that they were getting ad dollars based on our content, and that there was something like 85% of what used to be news media ad dollars was now going to Google and Facebook, that this was specifically money that they were making based on stealing news content and selling ads against it. Now, the problem with that was that any news company could stop Facebook or Google from scraping their news anytime you want. We don't want to do that. We want the traffic from Google and Facebook. So in Australia, similar legislation resulted in the big tech companies agreeing, okay, fine, we will pay out to media certain fees under certain conditions for qualifying news organizations. We agree to this premise, essentially, and we're gonna pay up.
And this was like the big ones agreeing to this, like Meta, Facebook.
Yeah, it was legislation for two companies.
Twitter?
Just Google and Facebook, which is a strange concept to begin with. Like, there is Twitter. There's lots of different social media platforms where people share news links. But the legislation was really targeted at these two companies. And what happened in Canada is that the news media got what we wanted from Google, who ultimately buckled and said, fine. And Facebook went the other way. And Facebook said, we don't agree that we're stealing news, but if you think we're stealing news and we have to pay for it, we'll just stop. There's no more news allowed. And Canada is now a country, I think the only country in whatever you want to call it, you know, the Western developed world. I'm leaving a little bit of room. It might be the only country in the whole world where if you go onto your personal Facebook page and say, hey, check out this news article, it won't work. You'll get an error message. You can't share it. You can't share it on Facebook. You can't share it on Instagram, and you can't share it on Threads. And that immediately wiped out, you know, 25% to 50% of traffic for a lot of online news sites.
Wow. Are there other things you want from the government? Like, what do you want them to do in terms of big tech? Like, because I feel like that there was a problem identified there that's real, that is affecting a lot of things, not only like the business model of traditional news organizations and independent ones, but also just our news and information environment and ecosystem and how people are interacting with the news and propaganda and disinformation and hate speech, all sorts of stuff.
That's it. It's not necessarily a kind of laissez-faire, like, I want government to stay the hell out. Like, I actually do want things from government, but it's about the rules. I want equal rules for everybody that allow us, that actually, like, respect what we do and allow us to do it. Once you interfere, we're a guinea pig, Brian. Like, just to get back to our earlier conversation, we can look at what's happening in the States and compare it to a long history of authoritarian rulers cracking down on the press and say, oh, the warning signs are here. Trump's following a well-established playbook. There is really no precedent for what's happening in Canada. You know, we're the experiment. We're the precedent. What happens when the government says, we are going to get into the business of determining who's a journalist and who isn't, and which journalism deserves to be saved and which journalism deserves to be excluded? We're getting involved.
Under the stated purpose of trying to help an industry and a part of civil society and of a democratic system that is supposed to be robust.
I don't know what to think after this conversation, because it feels like it's a bit of a damned if you do, damned if you don't, in terms of what type of government we want to be doing journalism under.
I mean, maybe. I think in both the things that are in common is we're talking about in the U.S. and Canada in different ways. The government is trying to meddle with the press, you know, like they're getting involved in kind of a more hands-on way, whether it's Donald Trump suing the Des Moines Register and the board of the Pulitzer Prize Committee, you know, like he's inserting the U.S. government into the dealings of the press. And that's also happening in Canada. It just, yeah, I think you mentioned it well. You're like, there's kind of the delicate terms under which the independent press operates in these societies, and they are delicate. And I think in general, like, staying independent is important.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you, guys.
That's your Canada Land. I hope you enjoyed it. Tomorrow on our weekly politics edition, you are going to want to hear this one. It is all about this big sweeping piece of legislation that Carney has introduced. It is Bill C-2. It has to do with everything from the border and immigration to the kind of data that your ISP is going to be handing over to the authorities. Check it out tomorrow on politics. This episode is brought to you by Caroline Knox, Will M., and Brian Kennedy. And they are helping us do this every week, and maybe you will too. When you become a supporter of Canada Land, you get the Thursday edition, which only our supporters get. It's called Off the Record, and it is about what happens behind the scenes here and why. You get ad-free versions of our podcast. You get discounts on our merchandise. You get tickets to our live events. You are helping to keep the lights on in our small news company. Please buy Canadian for your brain, for your information, buy Canadian, and become a supporter at canadaland.com/join or click on the link in the show notes. You can email me about today's show at jesse@canadaland.com. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. Audio production and editing from Caleb Thompson. Today's episode was fact-checked by Julian Abraham. Max Collins is our director of audio. I am the editor and publisher. Our theme music is by So Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV, 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it.
I'm Noor Azriyeh, and today we're talking about the news. We'll talk about why pets are becoming luxury items. We'll talk about the RCMP's quiet investigation into possible war crimes in Gaza. But mostly, we'll talk about grocery store whiplash. Right now, they've got us waving the flag, but have we forgotten the greedflation? The boycotts? What about the bread price fixing?
A judge in Ontario approved a $500 million settlement in a long-running bread price fixing case.
That's a lot of dough. Wait for that. Vass Bednar, public policy expert, grocery expert, co-author of The Big Fix, and writes the popular newsletter Rags to Riches. Vass, welcome to the pod.
Thanks for having me.
Grocery chains in Canada are notoriously terrible.
The country's biggest retailers, they broke the law.
Bread price fixing by grocers in Canada.
An alleged cartel. Loblaw, Sobeys, Metro, Walmart, Giant Tiger.
Grocery giants are struggling to win back their trust.
Canadians are fed up with high food costs.
Loblaws is out of control, a movement to boycott its stores.
Not just Loblaws, as you know, but superstores, value marts, independent grocers, wholesale clubs, Zehrs, Provigo, Dominion, on it goes, even Shoppers Drug Mart.
For those of you who weren't in the studio, Vass had her eyes closed the whole time.
I was listening.
Reflecting. Vass, we fucking hated grocery stores, right? Like deep unifying cross-country rage just a year ago. I remember the Galen Weston moment.
Mm-hmm. $4.99, that is a 150% price increase in one day. That is such bull Galen Weston. President's choice.
The Reddit group Loblaws is out of control with like thousands of people on that Reddit thread.
The group is asking for a reduction in prices of 15% and removal of member-only pricing.
There was this organized, coordinated Canadian boycott of Loblaws like around this time last year in May of 2024.
Many say they will boycott Loblaw stores this month in an effort to make their demands heard.
This boycott is kicking off as the company is reporting nearly $500 million in profits in its latest quarter.
Here's some headlines from last year. Frustrated shoppers boycott Loblaw stores for month of May. Small grocers, co-ops seeing boost in customers. Loblaw calls boycott misguided. Remember this era, Vass?
Oh, yeah.
Do you think about it often? I feel like I think about it often.
Well, I do.
You know, back then, pissed off Canadians were boycotting grocery stores. So how the hell are we in this moment now where buying groceries is somehow a glorious act, a glorious expression of patriotism?
Grocery shopping has become an act of patriotism.
Took me a little bit extra time to look at products, but all Canadian.
We have to do what we can to support our own economy.
Let me teach you how to buy Canadian at the grocery store. It is harder than it looks.
How much have you been hearing this kind of sentiment, you know, buy Canadian only these recent weeks?
Very popular item in cooking is onions, and it's a product of Canada, and it's on sale today. Maybe I should grab them, actually. I'm gonna grab some onions. Cavendish is a Canadian-made product, proudly Canadian company.
I feel like grocery stores are pulling off the rebrand of a generation, like better than the Crocs rebrand. Their reputations were in the gutter. You couldn't have caught me dead or alive in a Loblaws last year, or in Crocs for that matter. But it feels like they have been resurrected. Grocers, big grocers, have been like resurrected as holy sites of Canadian patriotism.
Holy sites.
It just feels like they've made a comeback. They've really capitalized on this moment.
I think they're frontliners in a lot of ways to that initial threat of tariffs and when people started getting a bit more interested in origins and kind of composition of food. I don't know that it necessarily gave them back a halo. The everyday activity of grocery shopping is increasingly a hostile activity. More surveillance, more barriers as you go out and to guide you.
Mm-hmm.
This hasn't been in Canada as much as it's been in the U.S., but more product behind lock and
locked.
Key. So I think people still feel skepticism or mistrust, and it comes down to pricing, transparency, fluctuations, mm-hmm. their understandability. Coffee's really expensive now.
Mm-hmm.
That's not just a jacking up the margins. That is a climate change and 100%. Geopolitical reality.
Mm-hmm.
So those are learning moments too, and it's difficult to do that when you're just grabbing at the shelf. But in terms of our experiences maybe with pricing algorithms or app store ecosystems, loyalty programs, and our information and kind of what's inferred around us, that's just part of the bigger conversation around the future of Canada and what it's going to mean to kind of reclaim our independence and our freedom and choice as consumers.
But it does feel like, I don't know, I've walked into a grocery store, like I've walked into a No Frills recently, and it was like Canadian flags draped on the aisles. And look, I want to know if something's Canadian, but there's just something so strange about grocers being the front lines of our patriotism. And totally agree with you. They have in some way become that because of the trade war. But I hear you when you say things like, people are still skeptical, and I'm going to get to that in like just a second. But I just feel like grocers have benefited a lot from the elbows up moment that we're living through. Like Mark Carney benefited because it won the election. But I feel like I don't walk into a Loblaws and my first thought is, I'm angry to be here, more so like I'm not going to buy those lemons because they're American. It feels like it's shifted kind of my own internal workings. But I do agree with you. There's a lot of skepticism. And I think that the patriotic shield is cracking because right now, as we're talking, as grocers are basking in the glory of their rebrand, we're finally seeing the fallout of one of the biggest corporate scandals in Canadian history, which is the bread fixing scandal.
If you bought bread in the last 20 years, you're likely eligible for some dough as part of a bread price fixing scandal in this country.
A judge in Ontario approved a $500 million settlement in a long-running bread price fixing case.
This really haunts us, right? It particularly haunts Loblaw Company, who voluntarily complied years ago with the Competition Bureau's inquiry into potential price fixing related to bread. They had their own kind of version of a settlement with Canadians when they offered a few years ago now $5 gift cards to everyone.
Another $96 million is accounted for in a gift card program from 2017, which Loblaw used to try and make amends for coordinating bread prices for years.
Dude, what a joke.
And this is separate but complimentary because it's a class action lawsuit. So it is quite a bit of money. I do have a girlfriend who confessed last week. She feels like she's been refreshing a page, being like, how can I get in on this? You know, we were all affected. Maybe it's a way to sort of put it in the rearview mirror, too. I mean, back to grocers, I do hear you. There's an appreciation for how they're helping us wayfind and maybe make different decisions or just like learn more about food and think about what we're consuming and what our dollars are supporting. But it goes back to this like public imagination and opportunity position, because what else could Mark Carney do related to groceries and the cost of living? Do we need to use government's power from a procurement standpoint? Do we need a publicly owned cooperative for groceries? Do we want to drop all the bullshit like storing, slotting fees, shelving fees, whatever? Can we imagine an alternative model? Maybe it's more online based. Maybe it starts in urban areas more. Like, what can we build? What else can we do? Those are the questions I think we should be pushing ourselves on. And like when you played that second clip, my eyes were mostly open, but I felt emotional. I felt like I was watching the climax of a Marvel film, and it just tugged at me for a second because I have found it quite charming, this idea that we can save the economy and save a bit of money at the same time. And look, something as simple as Canadians just changing their travel plans has had repercussions for the U.S. It's still powerful. And back to power, it's hard sometimes to feel like small micro changes we make in our everyday lives in aggregate, creating that sense of togetherness as Canadians, is actually a good thing. So, yeah, grocers are generally benefiting from that. But I'm also appreciative when I can see that sticker or, you know, that flag. I'm scanning for it, too. What I'm nervous about, I mean, nervous is a strong word. I haven't quite had a lot of experience with it yet, is that triangle or the T for tariff. Because a lot of the pre-tariff inventory is running out now.
Oh, yeah. And all the prices are now.
So now we're seeing these like price jumps, too, where it's kind of like
coffee's on that.
I just read about, I thought that class action stuff was settled. Everyone's trying to save money.
Yep.
And that's a new pain point. And maybe that pain point of the T, capital T, is going to be something that we subconsciously start to punish grocers for in our minds. Right? So this could be a kind of hedonistic euphoria where it was like we were all kind of in something and navigating something that was common. And now it's going to be like, every time I walk by the coffee aisle, I'm just like, oh, my God, what is going on over here?
Maybe I should try tea.
Yeah, I know. You know.
After the break, we'll talk about what it would mean to rethink our country's food infrastructure. And we'll talk about Canada's most quoted grocery expert, the food professor. It's weird because, like, it feels like we were having such deep conversations about what the future of our grocers should look like. We were talking about monopolies.
A June 2023 Competition Bureau report recommended all levels of government act to increase competition in the grocery industry.
There's competition and more competition. That means new entrants coming into the market and challenging the incumbents. And that is exactly what happened in markets all, elsewhere around the world, in Australia, for example, in the UK.
I feel like that conversation is getting lost in the sauce of the trade war. But what you're saying is that this is also another moment where something like that could happen, like conversations could resurface.
Again, there are other business models. It's just, what are our hopes? What is the role of the state? What can we catalyze? And where might we want to see price caps or price controls? I've written about this in the past. The NDP had it in their platform, the kind of grocery basket, right? How do we resist inflationary pressures? How do we guarantee that a certain subset of baby formula, pet food, core nutritious foods remain at an accessible price point for people? That's a more serious question. And we have to look at it differently than we used to 5 or 10 years ago because the global context is so different. And Carney's leadership, coming from Bank of Canada, Bank of England, being kind of like a boardroom guy, I think he does appreciate alternative models and how businesses work and also when they don't.
I'm glad you brought up Mark Carney because he did do something about the grocery prices that I feel like hasn't been getting enough attention. There's been a few international outlets picking it up, but not that many domestic. Let me read you some headlines. Yeah. Canada new tariffs on U.S. dropped to nearly zero with exemptions, Oxford says, from Bloomberg. Carney dropped most American tariffs day after meeting Trump, Toronto Sun. Canada's new tariffs on U.S. dropped to nearly zero with exemptions. That's the National Post. And elbows down, Canada's retaliation against Trump's tariffs is getting complicated from the logic. So Prime Minister Mark Carney has announced a six-month tariff exemption for products used in Canadian manufacturing, processing, food and beverage packaging, and for items related to healthcare, public safety, and national security. So those items that you were talking about, the prices are going up. He actually is reversing course on some of that stuff. He says that it was a temporary measure intended to minimize the negative effects of the counter tariffs. So we'll see if Carney reimposes them in the future. But as a result, he's gotten a ton of criticism about being wishy-washy. You know, when you compare his actions to his campaign slogans, like, this isn't really giving elbows up, it's giving elbows down. But the food professor, who's probably the most quoted guy in the country on groceries.
We're joined now by Sylvain Charlebois,
co-host of the Food Professor podcast, Professor Sylvain Charlebois.
Sylvain Charlebois est avec nous, spécialiste de l'industrie agroalimentaire.
Sylvain, we always like having you on the show because you always give us a few tips and tricks. Let's talk about the impact that inflation is having on those grocery bills.
Well, the food inflation rate at the grocery store is 2% more than the general inflation rate. So people are absolutely noticing higher prices everywhere at the grocery store.
He's saying that this is a good move, reversing course, because even though it was a politically delicate choice, it was an economically sound choice. And I just want to note the food professor long criticized for being soft on industry and hard on government. He's also made a lot of edgy and controversial comments online on Twitter. But I don't know. What do you make of Mark Carney dropping the elbows up stuff when it comes to the grocery prices?
I think that seems savvy. Sorry for my own whiplash on the tea and the symbolism and what to be looking out for and when. This is a ongoing process of give and take as we lead up to the major renegotiation. Mm-hmm. So it's maybe constructive that the food professor, that Sylvain, could show and rationalize his support for something. I've engaged with him a bit online, which is always a startling experience, but I did have the opportunity to guest lecture his class last year, and I would say that was a positive. I was warmly received and also received a beautiful tote bag. For my efforts that I have received compliments on. So connected to the food professor, and sometimes a good reminder that also people are real. We're all real behind our avatars and our online personas. And I did get to meet a person who seemed quite different than who he can be online sometimes.
Okay, so the food professor, kind of abrasive to critics on Twitter, maybe he's not such a bad dude in person. But, you know, something that he talks about often is the fact that the previous Liberal government did a lot of, like, political theatrics when it comes to greedflation.
They were dealing with this political hot potato with this greenflation campaign going on, which led many Canadians to believe that there is profiteering going on instead of just saying, no, there's no profiteering. They're just passing the buck on to the Bureau.
And it was all just like a bunch of sloganeering.
Come to a hearing.
It is really a low-hanging political fruit for the Liberals to go after CEOs right now because, let's face it, not a whole lot of people actually trust food companies right now. So it's a really easy target.
It's interesting to see him kind of shift in some of that criticism because in a recent op-ed piece, he said things like, symbols like elbows up and Canada's not for sale may have mobilized supports during a volatile political moment, but they should never substitute for sound economic governance. Rhetoric can only go so far. Did you feel like there was a lot of political theatrics when it came to the previous government's relationship with grocers last year? And do you feel like we're moving away from that, that Mark Carney is moving away from that?
Again, such early days. I had mixed feelings around the kind of like marching grocery CEOs or telecom CEOs to Ottawa to like meet with them, the kind of feeling of we're going to the principal's office now. Uh-huh. But I also had an appreciation for like maybe in Canada, that's what we do. And we're able to have these like frank and tough and honest conversations and get those business leaders in the room mm-hmm. who aren't saying we're going to threaten to leave or we're not even going to come to your meeting and to meet with the minister and have these conversations. At the same time, I hunger for and crave more experimentation, innovation, pilots. In New York City, there are major conversations right now from one of the mayoral candidates around a city-owned grocery store. There's momentum for that in Chicago. What momentum is here? What else can we try? What can we envision? What niche, smaller versions of this might we have in places that we can scale up and grow? People are hungry for alternatives. And I think a lot of the frustration in Canada with that movement, as you were saying, you know, Loblaw is out of control, was just that constraint and feeling like there weren't enough alternatives and there wasn't a choice and that sort of sense of defeat that you have to go. Anyway, to me, that's maybe I'm like always reading in my own frustrations or projecting like what I think it could be. We are in a moment. We're always in a moment. But like this is a particular moment of like possibility and optimism and imagination. And I think in a minority context, that can be quite promising, too. And part of that is probably going to be a reimagining of elements of our economy, both to produce more in Canada, build more in Canada, but maybe have other models, other kind of profit models, worker-owned cooperatives, state-owned. Again, there are alternatives out there. If we can imagine them, we can bring them to life, too.
Grocers are still up to some pretty crazy shit. I knew Big Brother dystopia was coming to grocery stores because I've stood in a self-checkout line. The vibes are really weird. And I think they might get weirder because I saw this article on the Globe and Mail published by Vass Bednar. Have you ever heard? headline, supermarket workers are wearing body cameras. Welcome to the new dystopia. Give me a rundown. You know, you've had your finger on grocers for a while. Was this a long time coming? Did you expect this?
No, I didn't expect it. And I've been fascinated by these pilots that have been run by Loblaw. I've also been run by Walmart. And there's anticipation that they'll be expanded. And again, when the largest companies are doing something, others follow suit.
Yeah.
I learned a lot from writing the piece. It's just a short piece. But I am the kind of person who not only reads the comments, like I get in there in the comments.
And I
don't have a funny name. Like I don't have, you don't get a response from like Vaseline55. Like you get a response on the Globe and Mail from someone named Vass Bednar. And it's me. My issue with the cameras is that it feels like an underinvestment in terms of this core problem. And businesses are saying, well, we're investing in worker safety and this helps workers feel more safe. And I did hear from some people both who have worked in these settings or who want to see workers better protected that they're like, if this helps them, then that's great. I agree. Things that help workers feel safer on the job are good.
Mm-hmm.
However, there are plenty of cameras already.
There's security guards at most
in
of these grocery
commercial
stores.
Commercial settings, yeah. So the other motivator is loss, right? Retail loss that people are stealing. And there's a cost associated with that.
Mm-hmm.
So this is really what we're trying to mitigate. And yeah, look, to me, it's a bit of a slippery slope. I actually considered buying a body cam because you can get them for like $30 or $35. You could buy it at Walmart. Or buy it in bulk from a company that primarily supplies like police forces, right? And then bring it to the retail floor and not increase people's pay,
right?
Not pay people more to do more security or not just frankly accept the cost of loss. Like, I guess the counterpoint is, which some people were writing to me in the comments, does it potentially ratchet up the hostility?
I was just going to say,
like,
that
the reason I thought about buying one, if it just to come to a meeting and just be like, blah, 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 and someone being like, Vass, what the heck is that? And be like, oh, you don't mind, right? It's just a camera.
Like, no, I mind.
Or it's like when you're on a Zoom and it's like, this meeting is being recorded. I'm and like, you're just kind of like, changes the vibe. Or even when I'm lecturing, right? Even when I'm lecturing, I'm like, I will deliver a better lecture or a better guest talk without the lair of that. So
yeah,
it was also just me thinking about like how our cameras changing how we experience everything. If I go ask someone who's working on the floor, like where to find something, there are certain items I always have trouble finding. Mm-hmm. Where is red pepper jelly? Is it in the jams or is not always where you think it's going to be?
Clear.
Where are the souvlaki sticks? Like I need them, but I don't want to be on, you know, in direct camera in a particular
way. But also if someone came up to you like and you're like lost in the grocery store and someone came up to you with a camera stuck to their chest and they're like, can I help you? I automatically feel like you think I'm stealing because you're coming up to me. Even if it wasn't the case, it's just the hostility of the camera.
Well, and I think statistically, people aren't getting hurt, right? Mm. Workers are not getting hurt. Corporations' bottom line is getting hurt. Cameras don't seem like the right solution to that. I don't disagree that it's a problem, mm-hmm. but just as I don't believe it is a cashier's responsibility to try to stop someone from walking out with something.
Totally.
These are huge societal issues mm-hmm. and in some instances, formal crime rings.
But maybe it has something to do with the fact that now there is a full digital catalog of what the worker's doing all day. How many
exactly.
stocks have been, where are the shelves and
yeah.
how many people you talk to and what times are most, I don't know. Mm-hmm. There's just something about that. We talked a lot about facing the camera, but even just wearing the camera.
So typically the way they've been deployed now is it's a choice when to turn them on. So they're not always recording, but I do think that's people's assumption that it might be the default or that's also the easiest thing to do. But you're right. It is a tacit form of surveillance of your peers. It's more information for the company and information that they can use to make business decisions. So I think it's worth resisting for sure. But I also don't want to punish any worker that does feel safer wearing it or doesn't have a choice in doing that. I think we need to remember where to direct our disappointment.
The body cams feel like the next step, this evolution of grocers and tech. Is there anything else in that intersection that's raising any flags for you?
One B that I cannot get out of my bonnet is the kind of invisible use of algorithmic tools. It's really hard to see. We do see companies bragging about it in company calls or stepping out in kind of a consumer retail report context, but it freaks me out. It's being called the end of a fixed price. So you and I both have coffees on our desk. We're probably always paying the same amount for coffee, but often in closed app ecosystems or when prices are set digitally or even with those electronic labels, prices can fluctuate and shift based on the time of day, the profile of the person purchasing. We just saw reporting in the U.S. from last week that Delta Airlines was found to deliberately charge single travelers more for their airline seat.
Are you flying solo? If so, you might just be paying a secret penalty.
So these kinds of calibrations,
it
stresses me out because it's so invisible to us that it's difficult to know. So there are places in the economy where we know that's going to happen. Airlines, fixed amount of seats, time pressures, we sort of understand that prices shift, but we have no appreciation of just how sophisticated that is. You and I shopping for diapers online.
Yeah, totally shopping for
adult or otherwise. I don't want the economy to be an algorithmic hall of mirrors. I want people to be able to opt out. I want people to be able to explain their prices. But it's a very kind of, in the most kind of academic economist way, that question is like a conversation about optimization. Oh, if there are different willingness to pay, then of course you should charge me $8 for that bag of chips because I'm going to go for the Miss Vickies. But like your threshold is $5.50 or something. Honestly, I keep seeing bags of chips for $5. I'm like, what is happening here?
Dude, Miss Vickie's is bankrupting me monthly.
And it's like a housewarming gift now for me. I'm like, here are two giant bags of Miss Vickie's.
Lime and black pepper? What is that? That's the best flavor.
Salt and vinegar.
Oh, that one's good too.
Straight to your brain.
Oh, it's so good.
Anyway, so to me, that kind of pricing is quite interesting because it's invisible. But I think the more people learn about it or realize that it is occurring, the more kind of disappointed and pissed off you are. And there's always that fragility of trust. We touched on it between citizen and state. But there's also been a huge erosion of trust between business and consumer, right? And we need to find ways to rebuild that. And part of rebuilding that is the state demonstrating that it has our backs and that it's realistic about what we're up against when we go shopping for everyday things.
That is our show for today. Thank you for joining me. You can email me about the show at noor@canadaland.com. I read everything you send me. You can also find me posting on Blue Sky. Just search up my name, Noor Azriya, and click the profile with a pretty picture. Vass, where can people find you?
On Blue Sky, on X, I'm Vass B, and I am on LinkedIn, actually, if you want to connect.
And you publish for the Globe and Mail.
And I publish for the Globe and Mail. And you know what? I get to hear from the most interesting Canadians every time I have an opportunity like this, like being on Canada Land. Thank you so much. And thank you to your listeners.
This episode is produced by the one, the only James Nicholson. Our associate producer is Lucy Lemonnier. She also does the fact-checking. Mixing and mastering is by Tristan Capicchione. Our director of audio is Max Collins. The editor and publisher of Canada Land is Jesse Brown.